Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Global Health Forum on Blog Talk Radio. This show is a public service of People to People, a not-for-profit 501c3 registered Ethiopian diaspora healthcare organization. I am your host, Dr. Timsai Loretta. Tonight, I am honored to have Dr. Celine Gounder, infectious disease and public health specialist, as my guest. Dr. Gounder received her BA in molecular biology from Princeton University, her Master of Science in Epidemiology from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and her MD from the University of Washington. She completed a residency in internal medicine at Massachusetts General Hospital and a fellowship in infectious diseases at Johns Hopkins University. Between 1998 and 2012, she studied tuberculosis and HIV in various countries in sub-Saharan Africa, including Ethiopia, South Africa, Lesotho, and Malawi. Dr. Gounder served as the director for delivery for the Gates Foundation-funded consortium to respond effectively to the AIDS-TB epidemic. She collaborated with National Ministries of Health and the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR-funded implementers, to conduct research on TB and HIV in Ethiopia, Lesotho, and Malawi. She then served as Assistant Commissioner and Director of the Bureau of Tuberculosis Control at the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. Dr. Gounder now works part-time as an infectious disease specialist in New York City and spends the remainder of her professional time as a physician journalist. She has written articles for The New Yorker, The Washington Post, and Reuters, and has appeared on interviews on CNN, Al Jazeera America, and CBS, discussing important public health and infectious disease problems such as the Ebola epidemic. She recently spent 2 months volunteering with the International Medical Corps Ebola response in Guinea. Dr. Gounder, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, my pleasure.
Okay. So, Dr. Gounder, can you begin by telling us a little bit about how you first became interested in working in the field of international and public health?
Well, I think that I really started to think about this as a career track when I was in college. And I think there were a few things that sort of in my background that set me up for having this kind of interest. Both of my parents are immigrants. My father in particular is from a rural part of India, where one of the common causes of death remains infectious diseases like tuberculosis. And so as a student at Princeton, was interested in the sciences, was studying molecular biology, but at the same time was also very interested in having a greater impact, doing something in the public service, and also internationally. And so during my time there, as students at Princeton, we have to do a senior thesis, and so my research was on eradication of polio. As you know, we still haven't gotten there quite yet, but I spent a summer at the World Health Organization with many of the leaders on polio eradication, trying to understand the public health approach to these kinds of problems, and came back and continued my studies at Princeton, and that was sort of my first taste of international health. And it was, you know, proved to be, for me, a really good combination of, as I said, the sciences as well as more of a public service impact, and allowed me to work with some of the populations that interest me, in particular overseas disadvantaged populations. That's really how I first got started.
All right, thank you. That's fascinating. And then it seems like you've done a lot of work over the years the various countries, and I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your work in Ethiopia regarding HIV and TB as an example of some of your work over the years.
Oh, sure. So when I was at Hopkins, as part of the the Gates Foundation-funded consortium to respond effectively to the AIDS and TB epidemic. My position was to collaborate with various implementers, whether they be ministries of health or NGOs, non-governmental organizations, to implement evidence-based HIV and tuberculosis programs. So the consortium I was working with had been conducting large, what we call cluster randomized. So essentially, instead of randomizing patients to different interventions in a study, we were randomizing large communities, large groups of people. And the research involved in South Africa gold miners, try to prevent tuberculosis among HIV-infected gold miners. In Zambia and South Africa, we were also looking at communities and how to find TB in the community and prevent further transmission. So based on that research, I was then reaching out to other potential partners, including in Ethiopia, to see how we could integrate the research findings into programs. So in Ethiopia, I worked with the Johns Hopkins Sahai group, which in particular we were focusing on Benishangul and Gambela, which, as you know, are more rural, underserved areas as compared to Addis, obviously. And so the idea was to integrate tuberculosis screening in the HIV programs that they were supporting to strengthen tuberculosis laboratory services and to help them develop their algorithms for screening a bit more thoroughly. So that meant spending a lot of time with the staff in the clinics, both the Johns Hopkins Sahai staff as well as clinic staff, and understanding what their challenges were and how we could best help them as well.
Okay, great. So so in a country like Ethiopia where there is a high prevalence of TB, is screening routinely done? Because just from my brief time there, I also noted that a lot of people are treated empirically if they have pulmonary symptoms. Is screening becoming more like part of the care?
Well, you kind of hit the nail on the head in a sense. One of the major deficiencies is laboratory diagnostics. Much of the diagnosis, if not almost all the diagnosis that is done, is either clinical or at best smear microscopy. So that means, taking a sputum specimen and smearing it on a slide with stain and looking at it under the microscope to see if you have tuberculosis organisms. And even that capacity is pretty limited. For a light microscope, you still need electricity, and not all the clinics had stable electricity and didn't always have the reagents to do the staining necessary. So a lot of times the diagnosis is based on, you have a cough and you're bringing up some sputum and you're having night sweats and you're losing weight, so let's try treating you for TB and see if you get better. But unfortunately, that might mean inappropriate treatment. They might have something else. They might have drug-resistant TB, and you don't know that, so you give them the standard regimen, and it takes a while before you realize they're not getting better. So there are a lot of reasons. We really do need better diagnostics in those kinds of settings.
Okay. All right. And is there a lot of drug-resistant TB in Ethiopia?
Fortunately, it's not one of the higher prevalent countries. Other countries, for example, Eastern Europe, South Africa, on the African continent, as well as parts of Asia, right now have higher rates of drug resistance. But of course, if we don't have the ability to test, we don't really know what's going on either.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. And then moving on to your most recent experience, can you tell us about your work and your recent experience in Guinea?
So I volunteered with the International Medical Corps. So this is an aid group, emergency aid group. They're in fact, in Nepal right now at the moment as well as in Syria and Yemen. So they respond worldwide to these kinds of humanitarian crises. And they had been working first in Liberia and Sierra Leone, where they set up Ebola treatment units back in the fall. And similarly to other NGOs that were working in West Africa, many of them were new on the scene in the middle of the summer last year or into the fall. So really they got most of them got their start trying to deal with, try to cope with the explosion in cases in Liberia and Sierra Leone. And Guinea was a bit different. They didn't have the same spike in cases. Guinea is where the epidemic started, and they've had essentially a sort of plateau of cases all the way through without the big spikes, but also it continues to transmit it in Guinea, and I suspect that's where the epidemic will eventually end. But in any case, come January, people were realizing they really needed to do more in Guinea if they were going to get the epidemic under control in the region. So I was part of the first group, essentially, for International Medical Corps in Guinea. And so, you know, when you're establishing a new country mission, there's a lot that needs to be done in terms of networking with other non-governmental organizations in country, with the Ministry of Health and other public officials, and really sorting out what you as an organization plan to do. And sometimes what you think you're going to do changes based on what's happening on the ground. So the project that we had been funded to do by the U.S. Agency for International Development was really reinforcing infection control and water and sanitation infrastructure in some of the rural parts of Guinea. And that is, in fact, where the epidemic started, was in the rural part of Guinea-Conakry, near the border of Liberia. But by the time I got there in January, and even now, the epidemic has really moved to the coast near Conakry and then down towards Sierra Leone. And so it really required us to change our approach geographically, as well as some of the emphasis and activities. So as one of the first people in country, in fact, even before we had a country director, you know, I was really responsible for trying to determine what we should be doing and networking with others to make that happen.
Okay. So it seems like the efforts were focused on, like you said, sort of the early public health aspects in terms of infection control. You said water control, sanitation.
Yeah, so, you know, and again, this is really similar to many health facilities in Ethiopia, for example. There's not running water in a lot of facilities. So you tell people to wash their hands and practice good infection control, and it's simply not possible. In many places in Guinea, the only place to get water, if you're lucky, is at a hospital or at a mosque. And so a lot of people from the community may come to the hospital not for health care, but to get access to the, you know, pump water on the hospital grounds. And that also creates other infection control issues, because you're trying to screen people as they're coming in to the facility, and you're having a huge number of people who are actually not really there for health care who also come into the hospital grounds. So that creates issues. And then there's issues with waste disposal, and especially in a hospital, you know, you have contaminated what we call biomedical waste. So, you know, all of the things that you use in a hospital, needles and, you know, gowns and all the different things that could be contaminated with body fluids and infectious with Ebola, we need ways to dispose of that safely. And many of these health facilities did not have that. So that's a lot of what we were working on, was developing those systems, helping to bring in safe water or address what the issues were in terms of distribution of water in a facility, making sure the staff were appropriately supplied with what they needed to protect themselves, and also implementing screening programs. And this is kind of where my work with tuberculosis dovetails with my more recent work on Ebola. In many ways, it's similar. You know, somebody presents to a health facility, and you want to screen them for fever, and in the case of Ebola, GI symptoms. So by that, I mean nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. And there are a few other symptoms we screen for. In the case of TB, as you know, we screen for fever, night sweats, weight loss, cough, and so on. So we're trying to implement the screening programs, but doing so in a way that's efficient and that the staff could actually practice that, you know, was essentially what we were trying to do.
I see. Now, was your work focused in one facility or hospital, or the larger number of hospitals?
Well, in Conakry, we collaborated with MSF, the Médecins Sans Frontières, at Danka, which is the big referral hospital in the city, the largest hospital in the country. MSF was really just running the Ebola treatment unit that was located on the grounds of the hospital, but they were really spread thin and couldn't also manage the infection control issues for the hospital itself. And so essentially we split up the responsibilities. We took over to do the screening at the hospital to help with the infection control issues there. And then those patients that we identified either as suspects or known cases, we referred to the MSF treatment unit. That's one of the facilities. The prefecture, so those are sort of like districts in Guinea. The districts around Conakry that have been most affected, Dubreka, Koya, Forcaria, where there have been many of the cases, especially recently, we also focused on their prefectural hospitals to reinforce their systems. That's essentially where we concentrated ourselves, is where the epidemic is currently localized.
I see. And aren't those areas more in the rural areas, or are they urban areas more?
Well, with the exception of Conakry, those areas are all quite rural.
I see. Okay. And then, this is an ongoing project, I'm assuming, but do you feel like there was some good progress in terms of achieving your goals?
Well, sure. You know, in any program like this is obviously a team effort within your organization as well as in coordination with others. But I think that we really were able to strategize effectively over those couple months, refocus our energies in a way that was going to be most impactful for controlling the epidemic. Danka Hospital, for example, as I said, is the largest hospital in the country. And in Liberia and Sierra Leone, large referral hospitals, unfortunately, became amplifiers of the infection. In Monrovia, for example, JFK Hospital had to be shut down because so many physicians and nurses were infected due to poor infection control practices. And that's exactly what we were trying to prevent and so far have been successful in Guinea. I think we have been successful, and I think we're certainly on the right path for bringing things under control and hopefully preventing another outbreak down the line.
Okay. And so that brings me to my next question about what was the biggest lesson that you feel that this experience can teach, not only in Guinea, but in other parts with other epidemics or even for other infectious disease epidemics?
Well, there are a couple things I would say. One, if I'm looking at the response to Ebola in Guinea as well as here in the U.S. in the fall, you have to acknowledge people's fears. And I think one of the errors we made in the U.S. was to jump into hyper-rationalizing, going straight to the science, which is correct, what was being said by many of our public health leaders. But at the same time, when people are afraid, they don't hear that. They don't hear this. And so I think at least acknowledging the fear, meeting people where they were at psychologically, emotionally, and then you can get into the science and what needs to be done and why. I think, unfortunately, because those fears were not adequately addressed, people didn't hear the science. They had a lot of skepticism and became hysterical. And in some ways, we've seen some similar things in Guinea and Sierra Leone and Liberia, people's fears not being adequately addressed. I think another major issue has been the politics. For me, that was absolutely fascinating to understand that. Much of this has not been covered in this country, but the politics and history of Guinea are quite interesting. It's a country that essentially was under dictatorship rule from the time it declared independence from France in 1958. It was the first country, by the way, in West Africa to declare independence, and was actually quite punished by France for having done so. And then was under dictatorship, totalitarian governmental rule up until 2010, when they finally had their first democratically elected president, who remains the president today. But then after that, they were supposed to have legislative elections, which were delayed several times before finally occurring, and they had yet to have local elections. And this is a major country people were saying that local elections were still being delayed and that Ebola was being used as an excuse to do this. And so they didn't buy into much of anything related to Ebola. They said, you know, this is a conspiracy by the government. It's not real. And it's a conspiracy to delay local elections. And, you know, so that was quite interesting to see. And then the other thing that came up over and over again was this expression Ebola business, where they saw a lot of donor funds coming into the country, and they saw that enriching local NGOs, obviously international NGOs, government officials. And when I say enriching, you know, in the sense of, well, they now had vehicles to get around, you know, nice 4x4s, or that, you know, you had expats coming in who obviously look, well, I mean, they do have greater means and do look more wealthy. And communities didn't understand why they were not seeing the money in their communities on the ground. And that created quite a lot of anger as well. So I think, you know, just observing some of those kinds of issues was really a very important learning experience.
Okay, thank you. So, and do you, now do you, we've heard news about, you know, the epidemic being controlled. Do you feel now that it's being effectively controlled?
Well, in Liberia, you know, we've gotten to, quote, Ebola zero. So we're 42 days, more than 42 days out from the last case that incubation periods. We still have cases in Sierra Leone and Guinea. Essentially, the transmission is occurring largely along the coast between Conakry and Freetown, so the two capitals. And, you know, I fear we're going to see continuing low-level transmission for some time. And the danger in that is that as long as you have that simmering, it can explode again, you know, especially if it is in Freetown and Conakry, two large capitals, both of which are much larger than Monrovia and Liberia next door, you know, that provides a source for reintroduction. We also have the rainy season that's hitting in the region now, which makes roads impassable in many areas. So it's a lot harder to address an outbreak if there is one that pops up in a part of the country.
I see. And, were similar efforts, you described some of the efforts that, you know, were being implemented in Guinea and that you were working on. Were those similar measures that were used in Liberia to achieve the basically eradication in Liberia for now?
Yeah. I mean, the components are essentially you want to identify cases, treat your cases, make sure they've been isolated from the rest of the community so you don't have continuing transmission. Got to trace your contacts and make sure they don't get sick. And then it's a lot of what I was working on, which is improving infection control capacity so that if you do have a case, whether it's in the community or in a health facility, that you don't have a transmission to others.
Okay. All right. Okay. So, all right, so then we may get a few more questions in our question and answer for the audience, but I'll just move on now. And I kind of wanted to talk about your career path because you do have a very unique career path as a clinician. You're a public health expert as well as a physician journalist. So I wanted to ask you how you ended up choosing this unique career path.
Well, I suppose it's a matter of having different interests and also just, you know, what opportunities arose at different points in time. After my training at Hopkins, stayed on there as faculty for a couple more years and had a really unique opportunity to work with this Gates Foundation-funded consortium, sort of a, you know, once-in-a-lifetime kind of opportunity. And so stuck around to do that. And then after that, was ready to take a little step back from international health, at least for a brief time, and thought that, you know, one way I could still keep my foot in that world was in New York City, which is, as you know, a very international population. And so worked for the New York City Department of Health for their running the TB tuberculosis program there. But then I also missed patient care, didn't really have a chance to do any of that at that time. And so then decided to come back to doing some patient care part-time. In New York City, I care for an HIV-infected population and am currently attending on the wards, so HIV-infected patients who are hospitalized. And it, as you know, it's not just HIV and other infections. Many of the conditions patients come into the hospital with now are really because of cancer or cardiovascular disease, and that's sort of what's happening as the HIV epidemic is aging, is we're seeing many of those other diseases in our population as well. But then, you know, I still wanted to be doing something in the public health world, but wanted to be perhaps a little bit more creative about it. And finally had an opportunity to pursue another long-time interest, you know, but you can only juggle so many interests at once. So finally had a chance to do some medical journalism, started out by doing some writing and then branched out into television. And I've really enjoyed that. I think, you know, it's really interesting in different workplaces, emphases tend to be, well, different. And so in academia, you become very focused in a very specific area. You become expert in that. Whereas in what I'm doing now with the medical journalism, it's more about, well, it's not more, but rather it's also about breath. And so every day I can be thinking about talking about a different issue. So earlier this week, for example, I was discussing multidrug-resistant typhoid in Africa and Asia, as well as the lifting of a ban on blood donations by gay and bisexual men in the United States. On Saturday, I'm going to be talking about sex education programs at schools in the United States and whether that should be abstinence-only or more comprehensive approach. So it's fun because it means, you know, thinking about all kinds of different things day-to-day, and so that's been quite stimulating.
Interesting. And do you what do you feel that the impact is of being a journalist as a physician?
Well, I think it's really important. I can give you an example of how journalism can have a big impact. You know, one story that's been in the news is, just in the last week or two has been this expose on working labor conditions in nail salons in New York City and the health risks of working in these nail salons, the labor abuses. These are often undocumented immigrant women who really have no recourse. And it's because of this series of articles that New York State has now announced that it's going to be regulating these nail salons, the working conditions, the pay. You know, so there can be very positive impacts of medical journalism. I think, unfortunately, what we saw in the fall with much of the Ebola coverage, and I really tried to be the voice of reason in all of this, but unfortunately, the hysterical coverage, in addition to the fact that we were having midterm elections at the time, fueled some really bad policy, and that's what led to inappropriate quarantining of persons who had been working in West Africa. You'll remember the case of Casey Hickox. And so, you know, journalism can have a very positive or negative impact, and I think we need more responsible medical journalists out there who give us science-based news.
Absolutely. And do you feel like, have there been cases where you've seen the impact? So, like, for example, I did see a few of your, you know, your talks on the quarantining and, you know, do you feel like that has been successful in changing people's perceptions and leading to actually policy changes?
Well, you know, I think oftentimes it's little nudges, I guess you could say, that you make with one piece. It's not, I think the New York Times series is actually quite unique in the fact that just two articles really achieved a big change in policy. But more often, you're sort of nudging people in a certain direction, and it's over time that you change policy. But I mean, to give you one example where, you know, a piece I did seems to have had some impact, I had written a piece, I guess about 2 years ago now, for The Atlantic about in-flight medical emergencies. And as somebody who travels a lot overseas on long flights, I've had to attend to, I don't even know now, maybe 8 or 9 medical emergencies in flight. And based on my experience with the flight crews and what was in the emergency kits on board, had some, you know, thoughts about how things could be done better. And the associations in the country that make recommendations on this reached out to me and incorporated some of what I was discussing in the article and some of their recommendations. So I don't know if that's what directly led to this, but I can tell you on my way back home from West Africa, I had to see two patients on the plane. Fortunately, they did not have Ebola. But, you know, I was some of the very pieces of equipment I was wanting. For example, a glucometer, which we use to measure somebody's blood sugar, and a digital blood pressure cuff, which allows you to check a blood pressure without a stethoscope. And, you know, unless you've had to do it, it might not be so obvious, but on a plane, listening to somebody's heart or lungs or for a blood pressure using a stethoscope is really hard. You know, you're doing that over the plane engines and it's hard to hear much of anything. So I was pleased to see, you know, some of that equipment finally incorporated in the kit.
That's great. Okay, thank you. So so we've reached the halfway mark of our show. Just wanted to remind our audience, you are listening to the Global Health Forum brought to you by People to People. My guest today is Dr. Celine Gounder, infectious disease and public health specialist and physician journalist. So at this time, we'll take any questions from our audience. Please feel free to call in and ask any questions. Okay, and so as we wait for our callers to call in, I had a few more questions for you. So Celine, what would you say the most rewarding aspect of your work has been? Actually, you know what? We'll take a call. We do have a caller now. Before we'll take a caller, the 410-298. Please press 1 to speak. Caller from 410 area code 298.
Hello.
Did we lose our caller?
I'm sorry, there was a pause.
Oh, okay.
Can you hear me?
Okay. Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead and ask your question.
Good.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I know you studied HIV a lot. You said in several countries in Africa. But I was wondering, because I remember in the news, you know, like about 10, 15 years ago, it was really big and it was an epidemic. We haven't heard that much, you know, it's not in the news anymore. But I was wondering if you can discuss, is there any areas where it's still epidemic levels? Has there been improved treatment? Or how is it now compared to 10, 15 years ago when I feel like there was a very big crisis in certain parts of Africa?
Well, I would certainly say it's still epidemic in much of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the news media has a very short attention span. I mean, same thing applies to Ebola. As the disease was not of concern to Americans, in other words, we didn't have cases here in the U.S., it really dropped off the radar, and that, you know, we still had transmission. We still now have transmission of cases. And same goes for HIV. You know, it's really not something that's in the public consciousness here anymore, but that doesn't mean it's not still occurring there. We still have very high rates of infection, and especially in Southern Africa, so countries like South Africa, Lesotho, Swaziland, Botswana, and so on. We do have much more effective regimens, but at the same time, the number of regimens available in each country is still limited as compared to the U.S. So if somebody develops drug resistance, meaning the medications don't work over time, they're what we would call second line or third line, so they're, you know, next best options, they don't have a lot of them. And so that creates problems. We still have a lot of stigma, and so people are still afraid of seeking care or of sharing their diagnosis with their partner, and that makes it harder to take your medications when you're trying to hide your diagnosis from people that you're living with. And unfortunately, PEPFAR funding, so PEPFAR is the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. It's a U.S. Program funding HIV interventions in much of Africa. That funding has flatlined, and so especially as you start to take into account inflation, that really translates into a funding cut. And there's been increasing pressure to turn over programs to local governments. But when health systems are weak, unfortunately, in some cases when this has occurred, patients have been lost to follow-up. They've stopped their treatments, and it hasn't been always a very smooth process. So we're definitely not, at HIV zero, and we are unlikely to be for, decades to come, frankly.
Okay, great. Have you noticed a difference in how, for how governments approach treatment of HIV, and also even now with this recent Ebola crisis? I know, sometimes government can be difficult to, deal with, or in these countries to offer help, but in your experience, has there been an improvement as time has gone on?
Yeah, in South Africa, where I've probably worked the most, there's been a huge shift in the government leadership's response to HIV. There was a lot of denialism about HIV in the early 2000s. We had a president and a minister of health in South Africa who said that HIV did not cause AIDS. HIV was fictitious. It made no sense to treat people with antiretrovirals. And now we have public officials in South Africa who really recognize the importance of these kinds of programs and who are real advocates. So that's been a real turnaround, which has been great to see. With respect to Ebola, I think we definitely have seen some, improvements. Most importantly, the recognition that health systems really do need to be strengthened, and that the fragility of those systems was really revealed by the recent epidemic. But the chances that we'll have another Ebola epidemic in the region, well, it's quite concerning because the reservoir is still there, the predisposing conditions are still there, and it's not just Ebola that we worry about. There's so many other infectious diseases that could emerge in these regions. So it's quite urgent that we do strengthen those healthcare systems. And I think they're, as I said, I think the public officials are seeing the importance of that.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you for the great questions to our caller. I think we have another caller, area code 410-961. Please press 1 to speak.
Hello?
Yes, caller, we can hear you, please.
Mm-hmm. Hello, Dr. Gander. It's been a very interesting interview. I was listening to how you work in different countries, like you said, South Africa, Ethiopia, Malawi, and I was wondering if you could just give us sort of a comparison across the different countries and the different challenges that you face when working, sort of what's unique to each country and maybe the biggest challenge in each country.
Well, South Africa is quite different from, say, Malawi or Ethiopia or Guinea. South Africa, you really have a two-tiered system. You have the, and unfortunately, in a sense, apartheid still exists, not politically, but in terms of the socioeconomics of the country, it's still very much there. And so the majority of the black population goes to public facilities. The majority of the white population goes to private facilities, and the private facilities are generally much nicer and cleaner and have they're better equipped. And so that does create, there's a lot of inequities in the healthcare system, which can also skew how public resources are used. In contrast, Malawi, Ethiopia, Guinea are more, I would say, homogeneously poor. And you do have regional differences. You have greater poverty, worse infrastructure, less access in the more rural areas. But it's not quite the same extremes as you would see in a country like South Africa. Now, that said, in South Africa, some things were better across the board. They do have better laboratory systems, even in the public sector. So, for example, if I had a patient in whom I suspected tuberculosis, I had access to not just the microscopy that you might be able to do in some parts of Ethiopia or Malawi, frankly not everywhere there, But in South Africa, you have access not just to that, but to culture, which is where we grow up the tuberculosis bacterium. We had access to susceptibility testing, which means that we could test and see which antibiotics would work. We had new rapid testing that's just come out in the last couple of years where we could get a test result in 90 minutes as to whether somebody was likely to have tuberculosis. So to have those kinds of tools at your disposal in South Africa, really, you know, that can be quite transformative if you have a system that is robust enough to allow you to make use of those tools effectively.
And then you mentioned the gap in the healthcare between the private versus public in South Africa. Is that something that, is that sort of disparity something that's improved over the years, or is that something people are addressing?
Yeah, I don't think it really has improved over the years. And I think the only way that will really improve is when the socioeconomic status of the greater population improves. And that's going to take a long time. And one of the greatest impacts of apartheid was the impact on education and training. And so, you know, much of the population doesn't really have much education and training, and that kind of disparity takes years, decades to turn around. So, you know, and look at us in the U.S., we're how many years post-slavery, for example, and we still haven't overcome those disparities. So, you know, I fear that we are going to be seeing that two-tiered system for quite a long time.
And last question, Dr. Gander, about you mentioned the microbiology, which I find really interesting. I did a little work in Ethiopia in ophthalmology, and in terms of doing cultures of the cornea, it was very limited. Could you mention specifically in Ethiopia about the culture, you know, the microbiology, what's available, and the limitations?
Yeah, so... let's see. In South Africa, microbiology culture is pretty widely accessible. In Ethiopia, it's really in the capital that you find it, in Addis. Let's see, in Malawi, it's also really just in the capital. Well, I suppose in Blantyre as well, so Lilongwe and Blantyre. But it's quite limited capacity, so not every patient has access. And in Guinea, also very, very little culture capacity in the country. So, and what that means is, if we can't culture, so if we can't grow up the bacterium or the bug that's causing the infection, if we don't know what it is, if we can't test antibiotics to see which ones will work, we're sort of stuck making what we would say is a clinical diagnosis. So we're you know, looking at somebody's symptoms and signs and what they tell us, you know, their story of what's been going on, and we make a best educated guess and we give them treatment. But we might be missing what they really have. So somebody might come in with a fever, we treat them for malaria, and that's our best guess, but they actually have tuberculosis. And that's sort of what happens when you have those kinds of diagnostic limitations.
Thank you very much. Very informative.
Okay, thank you to our caller for a great question. All right, I don't think we have any callers on the line as of yet, so I'll just return just a few more questions from me. It was interesting when you were talking about the healthcare infrastructure and how, you know, that is a big problem. Do you feel like these big crises, for example, HIV and Ebola, has that resulted in the strengthening of the overall healthcare infrastructure in these countries where it's been weak for decades?
Yeah, to talk about HIV, before HIV, healthcare in many of these countries was really limited to, you got sick with something, you went to the doctor, they gave you something, you got better. It wasn't really for what we call chronic disease, so high blood pressure, diabetes. Those kinds of conditions weren't really managed. And that one of the things that changed is HIV is a chronic disease. You know, you do need to go back and see your doctor every few months and have your blood rechecked to see how you're responding to the medication and so on. And so that really changed the paradigm. It changed systems of monitoring, and laboratory capacity and all of these kinds of things. And so what a lot of us have been talking about is, now that you have HIV programs in place, can we build upon that to manage other chronic diseases? As I mentioned, that might be something like diabetes. And in fact, many of our patients with HIV do have diabetes. It makes sense to start to use that as a platform for addressing other for which you do need long-term care.
Mm-hmm. And we, you mentioned a part of, basic access to, clean water and other technologies as one of the barriers. Have you also found that human resources is a problem? So we know in many of these countries there's been this big, large brain drain where there's, many of the trained healthcare professionals, physicians, nurses, they've actually left the country because of all these challenges, moving to the U.S.
Yeah.
or Europe. So have you seen that impact as well?
Yeah, I certainly have. And that's hard. Ethiopia, I certainly saw a lot of that, I have to say, mm-hmm. probably more there than any of the other countries where I worked. And it's hard because you also invest yourself in people. You train them with the idea of, you're going to be working together on something, and then they get a better offer, mm-hmm. overseas. So that can be hard. But I think it's not just that brain drain that's a problem. It's really along the entire continuum of the educational system. So, there's not enough or not high quality elementary school, grade school education, not enough opportunities to go to university. In Guinea, for example, I met with a number of medical students at one of the medical schools in Conakry, and I asked them, what are your job prospects when you guys finish? And essentially, they're looking at working in a public health facility. There are very few jobs because the government's budget is limited. And many of them end up opening up really underground, you could say, practices out of their homes where they see patients. And you can imagine, in the middle of an Ebola epidemic, you have all of these informal clinics out of people's homes. Mm-hmm. How are you going to strengthen infection control in all of those settings? That's really mm-hmm. difficult. But in any case, you need to invest in education from the beginning. And then you need to actually have jobs for people, and jobs that are not dead-end jobs, but where they have the opportunity for self-advancement, for further training and education. And without those kinds of prospects, it makes a lot of sense that people will leave.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. And then I also wanted to ask you, Dr. Kandra, you've done tremendous work over the years that you've shared with us today. I was wondering where you see your future work in the next few years, where you will concentrate on.
It's hard to say. It depends a bit on what happens. If you had asked me a year ago, I guess I probably might have mentioned Ebola, but 2 years ago, if you'd asked me, I would never have said I'd have, be working on Ebola. it depends a little bit on what happens, and that's part of what's exciting about working in infectious diseases is, some of these things are in flux. I certainly plan to continue pursuing the medical journalism. I find it really interesting, and I think it's a way to have an impact on public health policy and also at the individual level, personal decision making. For example, we had this debate over the last vaccination and the safety of that and public health impact of not getting vaccinated. As I said, evidence-based participating in the conversation, I think, is really important, because unfortunately a lot of the coverage that we see on the news is hysterical or sensational, and we really do need good information out there.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, it certainly does seem like it's a dynamic field, and that you're well prepared to be involved with. So, and then just the last two questions. So, of all the work you do, like you've described your tremendous work. What do you find that's the most rewarding aspect of your work?
Yeah, I think, and this is also why I like having a mix of different things in what I do. On the patient care end of things, today I saw a patient in the hospital, and it wasn't him. It was actually his neighbor. The two of them had come to be friends. They're sharing a hospital room. And his neighbor complimented me and our team on the excellent care we had given our patient. And, just those kinds of thank yous and feeling like you make a difference and help somebody out through a hard time, that is very rewarding. The Working Guinea, that was more of a picture program strategic level impact. But that you can see sort of how many people you could potentially impact in that way and the trajectory of things in the country. And then in terms of the journalism, as I said, it's a way of educating the public, but I also really like it personally because it allows for creativity. It allows me to stay on top of and learn about a lot of different things and to come into contact with different people to hear their stories. And going back to clinical medicine, that's, I think, what a lot of us physicians enjoy about medicine is hearing people's stories. And, so I think that's something that kind of ties all these things together for me.
Okay, thank you. And then just to close, I just wanted to ask if you had any advice to members of People to People, anyone who's listening in, on how they could contribute to such causes of addressing, global health infectious diseases in countries like Ethiopia and other developing countries.
Well, there are some very reputable organizations that are doing this kind of work on the ground, so you can always make a contribution, whether it's to International Medical Corps that I worked with, you have the IRC, you have Doctors Without Borders, the Red Cross, all of these Partners in Health, all these organizations do excellent work, so that's always a great way to make a contribution. If you do have relevant skills, to go volunteer, whether it's for a month or 2 months or 6 months, you can be very helpful in that way as well.
Okay, thank you so much, Dr. Gounder. We really appreciate your time spending talking about your fascinating career and your tremendous work that you've done over the years in international health and infectious disease. So thank you very much for your time. We know you have a very busy schedule.
My pleasure.
Okay, thank you. And thank you to our guests for listening. Remember, as always, you can help shape our program by submitting your comments and suggestions through info@peoplepeople.org or P2P's Facebook page. Remember, if you are unable to tune in live, you can access the archive show using the link on the People to People website. And be sure to tune in next week for our show, same day next Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern Central Time. Thank you very much. Good night to all.